Veterans Policy Radio, offering a unique perspective on everything. Geopolitics, culture creation, the reality of the world we live in. Coming to you live from New York City, your host, Pierce Redmond.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to another episode of Porkins Policy Radio. As always, I am your host, Pierce Redmond, and you can find this show here at American Freedom Radio, AmericanFreedomRadio.com, as well as on my website, which is PorkinsPolicyReview.com. And you can also find this on, all sorts of places, RSS, email. You can now find me finally on iTunes, which is a big help. As well as a rebroadcast later on in the week on a variety of other stations. So lots of places to go to find my podcast. And of course, if you want to support my work, then please visit my Patreon page. And please also support AFR. If you like the show, if you like me especially, then definitely go and support AFR. But today I am very excited about my guests. They are return guests. I don't believe they're on the line just yet, but they will be momentarily. Oh, they are on the – okay. I'm getting Danny telling me they are on the line. So we are joined by Stephen and Joyce Singular, who, of course, last appeared on episode 71 where we were talking about the JonBenet Ramsey case. And we're going to be discussing that a bit more today, and particularly a brand new I guess you would call it documentary that's out on Netflix called Casting JonBenet. But before we get to that, Stephen and Joyce, how are you? Oh, I can't hear Stephen or Joyce if they're talking right now.
Can you hear me now?
Oh yes, I can. How are you, Joyce?
Good, thank you.
Can you hear me, Pierce?
Yeah. I can hear you
okay.
Guys coming in. Good.
All right. Very good.
Good. How are you guys doing? Anything new from the last time we spoke?
Well, we always have new thoughts on this case, and so you know we did watch this show, and we have a few things to say about it. There haven't been any really major developments in the case since we last talked, but we've continued to track it.
Excellent. Well, before we kind of dive into the film and some of the things that it brings up and all the little nuts and bolts of that, this is as I said, this is ostensibly a documentary that's on Netflix. So if you have Netflix, I would definitely suggest that you go out and watch it. It is directed by Kitty Green, who is a very interesting director. She previously directed the film Ukraine is Not a Brothel, which some people might be familiar with. In that movie, Kitty Green spent many, many months, or years, I think, actually, living with femin activists in Ukraine. And I can already tell that some people in the audience are probably rolling their eyes at me talking or promoting femin or things, but it's a fascinating film, and it is very famous for uncovering the fact that during the earliest stages of femin, that it was really a man that was behind the scenes directing femin and orchestrating it and controlling many of the women that were involved in it. So it's a very fascinating documentary. And she also directed The Face of Ukraine, Casting Oksana Baiul, which employs a similar method that she uses in this movie. And essentially what it is Kitty Green sets up a casting call for a reenactment documentary, in this case a reenactment of the JonBenet Ramsey case. But instead of actually making that movie, what she does is she has all of these different actors. So she's got, I think, probably like six or seven actors that are being, quote, cast as John Ramsey and Patsy Ramsey, as well as JonBenet Ramsey. And essentially what goes on is she interviews these people, and they're all local actors from the Boulder area. They all have a intimate knowledge of the case, and as you watch the film, you'll see that some of these people knew the Ramseys, knew JonBenet, had similar things happen in their own lives. And basically they sort of go through the whole acting process of getting into character, and they do recreate several key moments in the case. And I'm probably not doing the best job at describing it because it's really something you have to watch. So I'd encourage people to at least go and check out the trailer, which I'll link up to in the show notes. And that gives you sort of a better idea of the film itself. But Stephen and Joyce, what did you think of the movie? What were your sort of initial thoughts on it?
Okay, well, I'll start, and then Steve will put in his thoughts about it. I initially thought that the format was very novel, and it kept my interest at the beginning. However, it didn't keep my interest all the way for the whole hour, because I thought by the end of the hour it got a little, I don't know, one note maybe. And then the second thing that stood out to me, and to both of us actually, was that for the first time in all the things that have been broadcast about the case, all the ones that came out last year, Lifetime, CBS, CNN, and the rest of them, for the first time somebody actually mentioned that they had heard of or there had been books written about sex rings and child pornography and that type of thing going on in the Boulder area. That got my attention because these are people that actually live up in Boulder. And, you know, for someone to actually say it in a public setting, I thought that was really very unusual. The thing that I thought a little, I don't want to give a spoiler, I have to give a spoiler alert here for someone that's going to be watching this.
Well, that's fine. Yeah, no. Yeah, there's plenty of spoilers.
Okay, the end of the show I thought was a little disjointed. I didn't quite understand all these, you know, reenactments of the, of maybe John and Patsy having these, you know, arguments and, that just seemed a little disjointed for the ending, for me personally. And then the last thing I'm going to say is that I mean, I'm glad that they're having shows like this. I'm glad that the true crime genre has now, you know, gotten so much attention on places like Netflix, HBO, like programs like The Jinx, Making of a Murder, and now this one that I'm watching and I'm just riveted by called The Keepers on Netflix. That one has a lot of the elements to me that I have found working on the JonBenet case, that this element of cover-up and secrecy. And it's very well done, and I would highly recommend that one also to your people listening that are interested in this type of subject, and particularly because crimes can be solved, you know, and have, and they could actually be impacted by these movies and documentaries that people are making. Unfortunately, in the Ramsey case, I think that it might take a very long time for the truth to come out, as in this case of the Keepers that took place in Baltimore, Maryland. That case was from 1969, and just now people are coming out and talking about it because they've been silent for so long, they've been afraid to talk. And I kind of think that maybe, hopefully someday, that same type of treatment will be given to the Ramsey case with the quality of the documentary that they're doing now on the Keepers. Steve, do you want to talk to about your thoughts on it?
Yes. I mean, to give listeners a little bit of background, if they're not that familiar, the Ramsey case, as we all know, began at the very end of 1996, and in 1997, Joyce and I started looking into it and tracked it really up to the present. But in 1999, I had a book come out on the case called Presumed Guilty, an investigation of the JonBenet Ramsey case, the media and the culture of pornography. So when Joyce alluded a few minutes ago to the fact that in this Netflix documentary, people talked somewhat about child pornography or sex rings, this book, Presumed Guilty, is the only book that I'm aware of, that we're aware of, that really has offered a third scenario to this crime. And the two standard scenarios that everyone talks about are the parents did it or an intruder came in the house and did it. And we have never gone down either one of those roads, but have tended to explore this much more as more of a social crime than a personal crime, like a mother gone bad
or a brother gone bad, something like that.
Yeah.
And looked more at the culture of the child beauty pageant culture, the culture of child exploitation, the use of child pornography on the internet, which is a vast industry and has only grown over the last 20 years. And so it was interesting, as Joyce said, to hear a couple of people allude to these things that were going on in Boulder at that time. our book explores that area of Boulder and what was going on in certain places, and again looks at the case that there are more alternatives than just two. So if people are interested in exploring that realm, you know, the book was published in 1999, then it was updated and came out last summer on Amazon Kindle. Again, it's presumed guilty. It brings everything up to date. And the most interesting thing that it brings up to date is that for about a year and a half in 1998 and 1999, a grand jury looked into the case, came to some conclusions, but those conclusions were sealed, and they were in fact sealed for the next 14 years. In 2013, those documents were unsealed, and what we learned was that the grand jury had in fact indicted the Ramseys not for murder, but for exposing their child to the people who killed her, which, if you think about everything I'm saying, that's precisely the theory that we were putting forward in the book, that they're not killers, they did not kill their child, but maybe inadvertently they put her in circumstances or around people who did commit the crime. So all of that is very interesting in terms of the developments in the case. The most interesting thing I found in the documentary, and again, I'm probably a little bit prejudiced because I come out of it as a journalist more than anything else. So some of the experimental parts I thought in it worked better than others. But when the actors were not talking about the case, the actors who are auditioning for these parts, when they were talking about their own lives, their own experience, they talked about being in morally ambiguous situations. One father talked about how his son broke the law, but maybe he was justified in breaking it, and he would have protected his son from law enforcement. Women talked about being sexually molested when they were young and how they never talked about it. And it's this whole moral ambiguity of this case that's really probably the most interesting thing about it. And again, think about what I just said about the grand jury. They didn't say the Ramseys were killers, but she somehow ended up in circumstances that led to her death. That's a very morally ambiguous position, and it's the kind of things people don't talk about. You say, well, people would talk. There are circumstances where people won't. And some of that came off of that documentary. I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, no, I think I would echo both of what you were just saying. I enjoyed it for the most part, the style of it. I think it's a really fascinating way of making a documentary. Joyce, I agree with you in that I don't think it really sustained itself for the full hour and 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I had some issues along the way that I think we'll get into a little bit later. But in a broad sense, I think it's amazing that they're covering the Ramsey case in a new way and in a way that doesn't initially just sort of cast theories that, oh, well, it was all the parents, because multiple theories are explored in this documentary, and Kitty Green does it in a way where she really kind of layers it, where we start with, of course, Patsy was guilty, and then we get, oh, but of course John was guilty, oh, but the Santa, oh, but there was child pornography, and it gets to a point where I felt as if there's some validity to all of these theories, that many people contributed to the horrific murder of this young girl, and that they should all be kind of we should be looking at all the sorts of angles and kind of bringing them together. And as you said, you know, like in the grand jury report, for instance, I always point people to that. The Ramseys were guilty of exposing their daughter to the people and events that led to her death. But obviously there's a lot more to that. And I do also echo what both of you were saying. I think it was very brave to bring up the sort of, you know, secret, this open secret in Boulder about child pornography, about child exploitation. I thought it was brave to also bring up the whole issue of Santa Claus and the secret meeting that JonBenet claimed to, that she was going to be having with Santa. We spoke about that in the, both episodes that we've done. And that, again, too, is something that people very easily just sort of poo-poo as a crazy conspiracy theory. But they bring it up, and it becomes very central to Kitty Green's film. So I thought those were all very, you know, important and very brave, too. You know, especially in a day and age where if you, you know, don't sort of follow the norm that the media and other people sort of put out there, you're labeled as, like, nutty. And I'm sure both of you have had to deal with this. Through, you know, the numerous cases that you've covered.
Yes, right. Definitely.
Yeah, so, and as have I, you know, of course, too. So that was a really kind of a fascinating thing. And, you know, there were like a few, as you said, too, I think the other really important part in this, and it's something that I've never really seen, and again, I have limited knowledge of the case, but the big thing for me was really that they, for the first time, humanized John and Patsy Ramsey. They're always viewed by the media, by the public at large, as these sort of cold, unloving people. Their body language has been analyzed over and over and over again, and people, oh, well, see, look at the way Patsy was acting. You know, that means she definitely did it. Whereas in this, oddly, even though many of the actors involved in the film do believe that Patsy was guilty, they don't, when they're sort of inhabiting Patsy, that's not really the message that's coming across. They really are doing this as, well, how would I be acting? You know, how would I be, you know, physically, walking around? How would I be talking to other people? And I think they really do a good job of humanizing these people. And the question of guilt or innocence almost become, with them two specifically, almost kind of becomes secondary because, like in a lot of high profile murder cases, we forget that these are real people, that they have real emotions, that we don't know how we would act. And there's one of the actresses who portrays Patsy talks about the murder of her own brother. And I believe her parents actually met with the Ramseys several times because of the sort of similarities within their cases. And so she had met them before. And, you know, she talks about how when she found out the news, she was screaming and yelling and she was, you know, totally lost control. But her parents acted very much like the Ramseys did in that they were almost like in a trance, that they had sort of left their bodies and they weren't really there anymore. And there's a bunch of moments like that throughout the film that really kind of show you that you really have no idea how somebody would act. And you can't go by a few press conferences and, you know, Larry King interviews and decide, oh, well, they did it, definitely, because, you know, of the way that they acted on Larry King Live.
You brought up that point, Steve, about character motivation. Do you want to expound on that a little bit?
Well, one of the things that fascinated me was because the case isn't solved, and because, you know, there are many things we don't know, an actor, you know, searches for the motivation in the character, obviously. If you have a novel that you're working from, the novelist has worked all of that out for you. In true crime, cases usually get solved, when documentaries or films are made. This is a totally different situation because you're auditioning for a part where you really don't know what the character's motive was because you don't know exactly what circumstances mm-hmm. they were in. And yet, I think, Pierce, you're raising a really, really good point that you cannot know what people have actually experienced or how they would respond to something. When I think about these cases, I always think of, you know, obviously something did go on that night or outside of that house. Perhaps the crime may have occurred outside the house, but the body was clearly brought back in. And this had to be done very, very quickly. And there had to be, you know, whatever best actions you could come up with. It would never occur to you at that moment that this would become, you know, the JonBenet Ramsey case. I mean, you're just scrambling to survive. You're just trying to do whatever you have to do to get through those few hours. There were reports, you know, that there were lights on in the house, in the Ramsey house that whole night. And again, without saying we know exactly what went on, this has just grown into such a phenomenon. It's such a part of our culture that we are all sort of somehow a part of crimes like this now, because we all have opinions and we're all trying to solve them.
And how would we know, how would most people know what it's like to appear on television on a national program when you're heavily sedated?
True. And what anything on earth, what is worse than being accused of killing your child in public?
Yeah.
I mean, try to come to grips with that. Millions of people suddenly are convinced that you've murdered your child. And, you know, for 99.9% of us, that just doesn't apply. So it's just a phenomenal, you know, it's just the whole phenomenon that we're looking at.
No, and a great point also to bring up that Patsy was, you know, heavily sedated. There's long sections in your book, Stephen, where you discuss that Patsy was, you know, taking all sorts of tranquilizers. That you know, she you know, you talk about the very famous story with her close friend, you know, sort of trying to put her to bed and Patsy saying all these sort of strange things. And again, yeah, I mean, how would anybody react if you're in a press conference saying I didn't kill or molest my daughter? And especially if we're going from the premise that the Ramseys had some idea as to who did this, and they're, you know, essentially terrified of what will happen if that is sort of ultimately revealed.
Right.
And there was another a great sort of theme in this movie too, is the whole issue of bedwetting, which of course became central to many of the theories as to how JonBenet was murdered. And I'm sure my listeners are somewhat familiar, but you know, again, there's this idea that because JonBenet was bedwetting quite frequently during this time, that Patsy somehow completely lost it and kills her daughter because she was wetting the bed. And there are some of the actresses and actors in the film do say, oh, yes, of course, this is what it was. You know, totally. She they use this ridiculous thing that she was turning 40 that, you know, she was jealous of JonBenet and she got angry that she wet the bed. So she murders her daughter, you know, bludgeons her over the head, then strangles her, then, you know, stages this crazy crime scene, then writes a 3-page ransom note, and then calls the police. And let that sink in, because that's really an insane, you know, I don't know who would think that this is possible.
You know, a woman that she hits her with a stun gun, too.
Yes, exactly. Right, yes, yeah. Right, hits her with a stun gun. And, you know, that's so, you know, somebody that has that much rage and loses that much control, could they possibly have the wherewithal to then stage the crime scene, write a ransom note, call the police, and then go on national TV? I mean, you know, think about that for a minute, logically.
And
you know,
also not only do all that, but then construct these complex nautical knots, fashion a garrote. Yeah, it's a lot to ask of someone, I think.
Yeah. Well, and you know, they juxtapose that in the film with one of the I thought she was real. I thought she was actually really great. She was like my favorite Patsy. Was this one woman talking about her own son who constantly wet the bed, and when he was being potty trained, you know, he would pee all over the house. And and she talks about how she completely lost it. You know, not to the – and we got all these
– Are you being – if you're being evacuated, Pierce, just let us know.
Yes, I know. Yeah, yeah. Well, no, this is
sounds
just
serious.
You know, typical 4:30 cop cars driving by. But, you know, and she talks about completely losing it, not to the point of hitting her child, but, you know, she talks about I didn't think that something so trivial could – get me into such a rage that I would be, you know, screaming at my son. And she says to this day, she is ashamed of how she acted over her son wetting the bed a few times. So again, that's, I think, you know, I really appreciated that Kitty Green stuck that in there, because I think we forget, you know, everybody wants to be the ideal parent, especially when a horrific crime is committed. Nobody wants to look inward and say, well, have I ever done something, you know, lost my temper in a way that is embarrassing? And nobody wants to say, oh, I've acted like this child murderer, Patsy Ramsey. But, you know, time and time again throughout this particular film, there are moments where parents act irrationally out of, you know, love for their children, out of frustration for their children. You know, Stephen, you brought up the father who admitted that he, you know, sort of hid his son from law enforcement because he was not going to, you know, he's not going to give him up. It's his son. And, you know, and he says he was justified in whatever illegal thing he had done, which, you know, wasn't murder or anything like that. But so those are really kind of fascinating moments. And, you know, my hat's off to Kitty Green for that. I do think, again, that it sort of falls a little bit flat at the end. There are also just some gorgeous, you know, sort of beautifully haunting shots of Boulder in the winter, you know, which are just tremendous. And it sort of made me, like, terrified to ever go to Boulder.
You've never been to Boulder?
No, I have not. I have not.
You know, it's stunning. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, and she does this wonderful sweeping shots of, you know, all these trees covered in snow and things like that. So really interesting. But I do also, there were a few things that did kind of, you know, jump out to me that I kind of wanted to get your take on. One of them is, and I was trying to go through my notes from Presumed Guilty, and I couldn't find it, but maybe you do mention it. Have you ever heard of this story that one of the John Ramsey actors tells, where they're at a memorial service for JonBenet, and the pastor of the church asks, is there anybody that wants to say anything? And this, he tells the story, you know, in front of hundreds of people. This guy stands up and talks about being in JonBenet's room and asking her where Santa lived, and she says it's in her heart, and she hands him a vial of glitter.
Well, yes, this is Bill McReynolds. This is the Santa Claus that everybody knows about. And, you know, the strange thing about that is that, like he's saying, everybody he talked to, he told the same story. In other words, if you were trying to conceal something, you probably wouldn't stand up in church and tell the weirdest story you could possibly come up with, which caused this guy on the film to say, well, yep, he's the killer. But, you know, he said the same thing to everybody. And it was just this little back and forth with JonBenet where, you know, something about glitter in his whiskers or something. But, you know, he was cleared. He was not considered a suspect after a brief period of time in Boulder. You know, he had a quadruple bypass surgery a couple months before the murder. They didn't think he could, you know, do all those things physically. So I don't think he's a serious suspect.
No, and it's important to note, too, I read a bunch of interviews with Kitty Green, and she, you know, did tons and tons of research. She says she's, like, read every book, so I hope that she's read Presumed Guilty as well. And she kind of came to the conclusion that there's no way at this point that you could solve the crime unless, and we've talked about this before, unless somebody or a group of people come forward with some real information. I don't know how you could really solve it at this point where there's nothing new coming to the table.
The DNA that they have, you know, hits a match, you know.
Right, exactly.
There's one apparently pure sample of male DNA from that was mixed in with JonBenet's blood that would appear to be, you know, very solid stuff. And if that could ever match anything in a data bank or anything they have in Boulder or elsewhere, you would probably have something. And also, as you know, it doesn't have to be the perpetrator. It could be a relative. So there's there was talk in Boulder at the start of the year that they were going to do new DNA testing. Now, I don't know if they have or if anything has come from it, but, you know, it's not completely dead.
Hmm. Yeah, and I think this is ultimately what sort of made Kitty Green sort of decide to instead kind of examine how this case affected people in and around Boulder, how it affected the Ramseys, and I think also kind of pushed her to sort of show them as human beings, you know, warts and all. And you know, and they don't come off as entirely, you know, pure as a driven snow, but they don't come off in this as cold-blooded murderers. And I actually think that for the documentary's faults in certain places, I think it does leave you at the end with, well, could they have really done it? You know, like could parents really kind of go to that place with, for seemingly for the most trivial of reasons, you know? And again, this sort of, I think as we talked about this the last time, I mean, this sort of falls into the, you know, crazy women, you know, are just capable of anything, you know, their hormones and things like, you know, it's a lot of this sort of bullshit, that we see time and time again come up. Another thing, that I kind of wanted to get your, take on, cause I don't think we've ever discussed it before, is the whole issue of John Mark Carr, who does, there are several very creepy actors that portray John Mark Carr. The one bald guy is particularly good.
Yeah.
The whole issue with, you know, in a nutshell, John Mark Carr is arrested on, I believe it's child pornography charges while in Thailand. And
right.
While he's arrested, he confesses to having killed JonBenet. Then he is cleared, I believe, and he says, well, it was a false confession. But I know that recently he has, in the past year or so, has stated that he was there when it happened, that he wasn't responsible, but he was there the night that this took place. And could you guys talk a little bit about John Mark Carr and what your kind of a perspective is on this guy?
Well, personally, I think the most interesting thing about him is that his computer went missing in California when he was extradited back to the States.
Yeah.
His computer went mysteriously missing. You know, that's the type of thing that happens in this case that raises so many red flags.
Right. I mean, we know he had some connection to child pornography. I mean, most people these days have that on their computers. You know, so if that, as Joy said, that's a very interesting thing, and nothing, we never really learned any more about it. I just don't think, you know, his wife said, as I recall, you know, that he was in, I believe, Louisiana during that Christmas week of 1996. There were other similar reports. So, again, this falls into the truth is stranger than fiction category, you know. But people do confess to crimes they didn't commit, and I think that's what happened in this case.
Mm. And John Mark Carr also kind of seems to fit into this, you know, category of pedophiles that were obsessed with JonBenet, at least.
Absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
You talk about in the book, there was a guy who was arrested somewhere around Boulder several years after, and he had a photo of JonBenet.
Right.
You know, there were lots of child porn rings that were busted where there were photos of JonBenet from pageants, that there were photos of JonBenet's face, you know, superimposed
right.
on other people's bodies.
Right.
So, you know, John Mark Carr seems to kind of fit into that realm of you know, people were just obsessed with her.
Yeah.
And this goes deeper to the fact that, you know, child pageants were this sort of they were a breeding ground for pedophiles, and also that, you know, pictures of this young girl and probably many, many others were floating around within those circles, that this wasn't out of the norm for you know, at that time, and it I assume it's probably only gotten worse and creepier.
Well, when you think about it, you know, and different pageant mothers had told us this when we were initially interviewing them, that, you know, it wasn't prudent to leave your child alone when they were dressing or undressing for certain pageants or for certain photographers. Because if you think about it, look how easy it would be for a photographer to take a picture of an innocent child and then put it on a computer somewhere without the parent knowing. And then peddled on the, you know, on the black market, on the dark web. Or back then they didn't, I don't think the dark web was in existence, but there were still these dark recesses of the web where these things could be, you know, bought and traded. So I think that, you know, the whole climate of child photography, child pageants, you just don't know who's fixating on someone as beautiful as JonBenet. I mean, it could have been a photographer. It could have been pageant sponsors, pageant judges. The list goes on and on of the type of person that you might have accidentally stimulated by dressing the little girl and, you know, and with so much makeup and in these provocative costumes. You don't really know who you're stimulating when you do that.
When we talked to those mothers, the thing that struck me anyway was that a couple seemed attuned to that, you know, to that sort of dangerous underbelly. And the feeling that I got from it is that Patsy was very naive, that she'd come up in that, you know, child or that beauty pageant world at an earlier time where, you know, you didn't have the internet, you didn't have all these ways of making money around this stuff, and that she would not necessarily have been nearly as street smart or as aware of the kinds of things that might be going on around her child. Whereas some of these other women would just say, you know, I'm never leaving the room so my little girl can change a dress in front of this guy. And they worked with these photographers, knew them and liked them. They still didn't completely trust them. Mm. So, you know, this stuff was going on.
Mm. Well, yeah, again, I mean, you know, Pam Griffin, who's a big source for you, who was also involved in pageants, you know, said she would never, ever allow her daughter to be alone with any of these guys. And, you know, people who are familiar with our shows on this, I mean, we'll know, you know, Randy Simmons, the photographer who acts, I mean, so bizarre. I mean, if he wasn't involved, he definitely knew of something that was going on. And, you know, again, too, Joyce, you're just saying that who knows who they, you know, excited with these things. And that, you know, just reminded me of the blonde man who's in the background of several pictures, looking at JonBenet, that only, you know, many years later did Pam Griffin sort of, think of that and sort of point to that, you know, who is this guy? Why does he appear in so many different photos in the background? You know, so there's a, again, I mean, there's so many, levels to this case. Another thing that I kind of wanted to get your perspective on, because it's sort of impossible to avoid when you're, talking about the JonBenet case, when you're making a film or, writing a book about this, is the sort of issue of, like, the continual exploitation of JonBenet. You know, every year on the anniversary, particularly on this last anniversary, which was 25 years or 20 years. 20th anniversary. You get a lot of news outlets running pictures of JonBenet. You know, some of them running some of the more, suggestive, pictures of JonBenet. And it sort of raises this question again of, you know, while you're claiming that, that Patsy had to be doing it and this is so horrible and they were exploiting their daughter, you're exploiting JonBenet by, you know, continually showing these images. And I want to know what you guys thought of, the young girls that play JonBenet. They're actually really only in the movie for a very brief period of time, which I was happy about.
Yeah.
But what did you think of that?
Well, yeah, that's interesting that you bring that up. You can't help but wonder what those little girls are thinking about the role that they're being cast for, correct? I mean, they have very limited knowledge of what was going on, but the fact that you just said that reminds me of a story that I must share with you. I got a call from a relative, and she's only 9, and she was asking if she could read the book. And, you know, and I said, well, why do you want, she's 9, why do you want to read the book about JonBenet? She wouldn't exactly tell me, but I surmised that what happened is after casting JonBenet and after this myriad of shows that came on and flooded the airwaves when, you know, the 20th anniversary, that some of these young kids saw parts of these shows or heard something, heard their parents talking about it or something, and they were probably talking about it at school, and then she said, oh, my, you know, my uncle has written a book about this, and she wanted to read it, maybe take it to school and show it. I think it's really fascinating to kids of that generation that they hear, you know, so much information about this little girl that died. And I made sure that I said to her, listen, you don't have to be worried about anybody coming in and breaking into your house and getting you, or what, you know, or your mother killing you, or your father killing you, or your brother killing you. This is a very unusual case, and it's not going to happen to you. But I think it's just natural for a child's mind to go there. We were really taken aback that a 9-year-old kid wanted to read that book, you know.
Yeah.
And I said, no, you can't read it because there's too many – I told her mother, there's too many graphic things in it. It's not appropriate for a 9-year-old to be reading about that.
No, absolutely. And, I mean, that's a great point, too, and just that that so many young kids are kind of inundated with – and I think this sort of goes to the culture, you know, internet culture that we live in, and the sort of news media culture that we live in, where this is sort of unavoidable. You know, you think,
and they don't feel,
you know,
safe. They don't feel safe, you know.
Right. Oh, exactly. I mean, just, you know, what, 48 hours ago, this bombing in Manchester.
Right. It's everywhere. If this generation has grown up with these images that the world is not a safe place, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
What I've always found interesting about the case is that we do live in that culture, and you know, more and more so with the internet, you know, child pornography. And I know when I wrote the initial book in 99, there were 5,000 child porn websites in 97. By 2000, there were 100,000. You know, it's obviously, I mean, advertising with young girls and stuff like that. But there's this reflexive action on the entire part of the culture that one person is responsible for all this. You know, Patsy did it. If Patsy did it, that's the end of the story. We don't have to think about anything else. We don't have to think about our own, you know, titillation around this whole subject and all the rest of it. It's just a very interesting social phenomenon to me. If we can just pin it on one person and put it away, we don't have to think about it. And it just doesn't seem to me to add up.
Well, no, and again, I think that it goes back to sort of what I was saying before, where if you're a parent looking at this case, especially at that time, of course you want to say, well, it was all Patsy. You know, she lost it and she did it, and the husband kind of helped cover it up, and that's the end of it. And we don't need to look any deeper. We don't need to look at you know, like in the subtitle to your book, the culture of pornography, that children are constantly being exploited, not necessarily in like a graphic, you know, sexual way like with child porn, but just the whole pageant thing, the way advertising works. I mean, you can just look at, you know, girls' fashion has become more and more provocative over the years, you know, to a point where, you know, you do wonder, like, you know, why are clothing manufacturers selling clothes? You know, why are they trying to make young girls look older continually over and over again? You know, and what does this do to the psyche of, you know, men worldwide? You know, that's something that we talked about before, Stephen. And I will say, you know, another interesting sort of note on that in the film is that, one, I have no idea what would be going through these girls' minds. I mean, they, while I'm sure they're very, you know, their knowledge is limited, presumably they're from Boulder, so they have to know something. You know, there's something going on, they're somewhat aware. And then, you know, interesting moment in the movie is when they're, the makeup artist is applying makeup to them, and none of them look happy at all. They look very uncomfortable. They don't, you know, they don't want to do it. One of the little girls is like, do I really have to wear a wig? Why do I have to wear a wig? And I found that to be kind of an interesting and sort of made me uncomfortable, you know, as well, because it's, you just sort of wonder, did JonBenet feel like this at points? And it was just sort of interesting that you would, and maybe that was sort of me being optimistic and sort of saying that there are, you know, hopefully there's a new generation of young kids that are not so comfortable with this and don't want to be kind of paraded around basically in front of just adults. You know, other little kids are, I mean, I'm sure they want to win, but they're not, you know, it's not kids judging other kids. It's grown men and women.
There are certain kids that respond to it and like it, but I think JonBenet was one of them. But I don't know if you've ever watched that show called Toddlers and Tiaras.
Yes, I have seen it.
If you've seen that, you've seen there are kids that are not comfortable with it, and they're more being pushed into it by their parents. And you feel bad for the kid because you can tell they just would rather be out playing outside or riding a bike or getting dirty, and some of them look miserable.
Well, that just reminds me too of I don't know if either of you two have followed the, you know, Honey Boo Boo, which is this reality show, and and you know, that's, it's only come to light in the past couple of years that, you know, Mama June, the mother, was, I mean, only dated pedophiles, apparently. And that, you know, some of these guys that she was bringing home were abusing some of her own kids. You know, so it's not, that world still exists. And I mean, that's like the ultimate exploitation of children on so many different levels with that show. You know, making her kids into these, first making them into pageant stars and then, you know, putting them on television and using them for money and fame. And apparently this woman, was not a good mother, whatsoever.
Let me just insert one thing there. I mean, Joyce and I have actually worked on three books where women have killed, women have committed murders. And in every case, I mean, it's exactly what you're laying out. There is some sort of pathology in the background. There's something there. There's a psychological profile. There's a pattern of behavior. There's a number of things. None of that applies in this case. Absolutely none of it. So that's, I mean, for people who so easily tag this onto Patsy, you know, none of that exists. It would have been totally out of character.
Oh, exactly. And I mean, again, I encourage anyone out there who is still under the impression that this was the parents to really, you know, read your book, because you do lay out that, Patsy did not fit the profile of a woman who does something like this. John Ramsey did not fit the profile of a father who abuses his daughter, which is, again, it's just that knee-jerk reaction in society to be like, that's the bad guy. End of story. You know, I'm not going to look at I'm not going to look at myself. I'm not going to look at people within my family that might be doing some questionable stuff. Again, there's a woman in casting JonBenet. You talk, you know, she was molested by a relative and a neighbor. And you know, we never want to look at those people, you know, because they're we want to be trusting.
Nature, you know, nature abhors a vacuum. People see something and they want to fill up the space with, you know, and like Steve said, to just make it go away. Oh, that couldn't exist. Oh, it had to be this. It had to be that. But there's a reason why that case hasn't been solved for 20 years. Yeah. There's a real reason for that. It can't be solved. Not right now, anyway. There's too much at stake.
What shuts everybody up? What causes a district attorney to have grand jurors sit for 13 months, which grand jurors usually sit for a week or two on a case, for 13 months to listen to evidence, testimony, etc., to ask them to do their job, to come back with indictments, and he won't sign the indictments. He will not pursue the case. Why? Mm. Why would he do that after having those people do all that work? Because what do the indictments say? That this was not contained within the household, that this is not just about a family, it's about something bigger than a family. And that's the legal record that's here. I mean, that's what I wish in all of these shows that have been on, you know, ever since last summer, last September. I mean, you have one of the very, very few shows where this gets talked about. All of it implies a larger social crime and a larger social reality.
Mm. And, you know, I found it fascinating too when the whole issue of pornography and child abuse in Boulder is brought up. You know, the one actress who brings it up is you know, shockingly nonchalant about it. You know, it's just sort of, again, that this was sort of an open secret. And she kind of, you know, dismisses it, but is like, yeah, it was a thing. You know, there was this, there were many people in Boulder that tended to believe that this was part of, as you said, a much larger social phenomenon and a much larger, you know, conspiracy within Boulder, that there were multiple people involved. That, and that, you know, when she brings it up, it's, people weren't like shooting it down, you know? People were sort of like, well, yeah, of course, it's Boulder, you know, which is, I mean, horrifying to think about. We're getting up towards, the end of the hour. So are there anything else, related to this movie or to the case that you wanted to talk about? One thing I'll throw out, I thought it was interesting that when they, talk about Burke, which is JonBenet's younger brother, as being the killer, you know, and, they just sort of say, oh yeah, he did it. And then they talk about, you know, but a little kid couldn't bash in, a girl's skull. And they, of course, they have the kids, you know, hitting a watermelon, and many of them break it, but some of them don't break it, which I thought was interesting. You know, of course, like in the CBS show, documentary that came out, you know, the kid breaks it like in one go. Thus meaning, of course, Burke did it, you know, because this one kid is able to do it. So I like that they showed that some of these kids, I mean, they could barely hold the flashlight. It was so heavy. Anything else in the film, or about the case that you kind of want to impart on the listeners?
Well, I never, you know, really thought about this until right now, but, you know, if we take the grand jury as a sort of template for what may have happened here, in other words, two parents probably inadvertently exposed their child to something that ended in her death, but something else happened that prevents them from talking about it or telling the truth. If you want to talk about an acting job, you know, somebody being in an actual situation of having to act, I think that's an incredible challenge if this would ever come out as some form of drama or something like that. Because I think it goes to the heart of this kind of moral ambiguity that some of these actors talked about on the show. I think what you said earlier, Pierce, these are human beings. These are people. And at least for myself, I feel like they were trapped in an absolutely horrible situation and had to make the best of it as quickly as they could and could never imagine what was going to happen to them after that. And, I mean, if you just look at it as pure drama, that's about as dramatic as it gets. You know, you have to lie to the police. You have to lie to the authorities. You have to lie to your friends. You have to lie to everybody to think, to at least try to protect what you have left. And that, you know, that is, like Joyce is saying about this other show, these real life situations are more fantastic, more complicated, more layered than most things we can think of.
Joyce, anything you want to leave the listeners with?
Well, I just want to thank you for having a discussion that is open to other theories. We get real tired of just hearing the same old, same old. So I really, you know, kudos to you to being open-minded and not just and thinking outside the box and being open to other theories. I think more people need to think along those lines in order for something like this to be solved.
Yep, I totally agree with that.
Well, I thank you. I mean, that's a huge compliment coming from both of you. Quickly, because we have just a few more minutes, Stephen, have you seen the news that O.J. Simpson is going to be going before the parole board in July?
Yes, I have.
We saw that.
Okay,
yesterday.
Any quick thoughts from you two on, you know, is it possible? Will he get paroled? What do you think?
I told Steve when I saw that, I said, I bet anything that the Goldmans will be there, you know, at the parole hearing, and they just like at the Manson hearings, and say absolutely he cannot be paroled, you know.
In any other circumstances, he would absolutely be paroled. He served 10 years for, you know, not a very major criminal situation. He would absolutely be paroled. If the system works as it works most of the time, he'll get out.
No,
but
I know.
But his prejudice hangs over from the other stuff.
What do you think will happen, Pierce?
I don't think he's going to get it. I think, like you said, I think the Goldmans are going to definitely show up. I'm assuming that right now with the news that his parole hearing is going to come forward, they're going to get their PR machine into full overdrive. I think we're going to see, you know, more of these sort of bogus stories like the, you know, that OJ and Casey Anthony are going to do a reality show together. You know, we're going to start seeing more of those sorts of things planted in the media. And of course, you know, it come to fruition. But we are coming up on the break, and I just want to thank Stephen and Joyce Singular again for joining me. You can find all of their work at stephensingular.com, and I am sure that we will be having them back on the show very soon.
Thanks, Pierce.
Thanks, Pierce. Thanks so much.
Welcome to the world's meeting place. American.
It's practically narcotic.
Freedom.
Oh, yes. I like very much.
Radio.
You're an American institution.
American Freedom Radio.
And I hope people support American Freedom Radio. And I hope people vote with their dollars and really understand the value of having American Freedom Radio. Because that's my family. If you love me at all, Jack Blood, support American Freedom Radio. Like, my family has literally disowned me in American Freedom Radio. Danny and Don and those guys, those are my actual family. So please, please support these guys because they have all the technology, they have all these great things that they're gonna do, but obviously they can't do it all by themselves. So not only would I like to see you support them, I'd like to see you retweet them and repost them and really get involved and get on the bandwagon, so to speak, on doing that do-it-yourself promotion, because they're a do-it-yourself radio network, and we just need that so much.
Did you know there are 3 million edible food plants on Earth, and none have the nutritional value of the hemp plant? HempUSA.org offers you hemp protein powder. It does not contain chemicals or THC, is non-GMO, and is 100% gluten-free. Hemp protein powder burns fat, builds muscle, contains 53% protein, and feeds the body the nutrients it needs. Call 888-910-4367 and see what our powder, seeds, and oil can do for you. Only at HempUSA.org. HempUSA.org introduces 3 brand new detox formulations of micro plant powder. Brain Fuel for depression, bipolar disorders, and stress. Total Care, anti-cancer agent that cleans the liver and organs and increases memory. Rejuvenate, invigorates and heals the body, mind, and spirit. These products are your alternative to pharmaceuticals. Call 888-910-4367 and like us on Facebook. We ship worldwide. Only at HempUSA.org.
We all know that they're not telling us the truth. So stand up for your rights, demand the real medicine, and your right to use it and grow it. This is Rick Sensen, and you're listening to American Freedom Radio.
What about show business? Show business, completely dishonest, corrupt, and full of shit, but in a nice way. Plenty of expensive drugs and perverted sex. If you're going to be full of shit, might as well enjoy your work. Then you have the media, not just the news media, let's include them all. The media are almost literally exploding with bullshit because they're located right at the crossroads of all the other bullshit. The media are made up of equal parts advertising, politics, business, public relations, and show business. These people are sitting right at bullshit junction. There's enough bullshit in the media for Texas to open a branch office. And you still have enough left over to start 2 law firms and a Christian bookstore.
What has American Freedom Radio ever done for us?
Provide us for free education?
Well, that's obviously effective, but apart from reversing the dumbing down of America...
All the information they provide is free?
What about the free podium for broadcast activists to speak from, man?
Exploiting commonplace corruption?
They help vulnerable people who don't have a voice?
Bringing light to important information nobody else does.
Or they never censor, hang up, or cut off their guests?
Well, that's not fun, is it?
Well, they created a fantastic alternative media source during an era of bad, manipulative, and infiltrated mainstream and alternative media shills and scum.
Okay, well, apart from the free education, free information, free podium for broadcast activists to speak from, exposing commonplace corruption, helping vulnerable people without a voice, bringing light to important information nobody else does, and creating a fantastic commercial-free alternative media source in a sea of bad, manipulative mainstream and alternative media shills and scum, what has American Freedom Radio ever done for us?
Donate to American Freedom Radio today.
No rules, no rules, no taboo topics, no taboo topics, no fear of doom, no fear of doom. We are American Freedom Radio, American Freedom Radio.
Hawkins Policy Radio, offering a unique perspective on everything. Geopolitics, culture creation, the reality of the world we live in. Coming to you live from New York City, your host, Pierce Redmond.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to Porkins Policy Radio. I am your host, Pierce Redmond. If you are just joining me right now, in the first hour, we were talking with good friends of the show, Stephen and Joyce Singular, who, of course, Stephen has written Presumed Guilty, which is all about the JonBenet Ramsey case, and we were discussing this new film, Casting JonBenet, which I encourage people to go out and watch. It's a very it's not a perfect film, but it's a fascinating way of making a documentary, and they bring up a lot of really important issues in that. So definitely check that out, and of course check out all of the shows that I've done with Stephen and Joyce on JonBenet, and of course you can definitely check out all the stuff that Stephen and I have done on the O.J. Simpson case and Mark Furman, and of course Stephen wrote the book Legacy of Deception, which is all about Mark Furman and the LAPD and OJ, and I'm sure I'm just sort of talking, preaching to the choir here with that. But anyway, I do have quite a lot to get into in this second hour, but I just wanted to take a moment and say that here at AFR, we are in the midst of a bit of a funding drive right now. We've got a lot of really fascinating things on the horizon for AFR. We want to bring on more amazing hosts like myself and Ed Opperman, Chuck Ocelli, and others. We want to update the website. So if you can, please, donate whatever is possible right now. I know that money is tight for everybody out there. Don't break the bank, but if you can help support AFR, it's greatly appreciated, and I will of course link up to the direct PayPal donation for AFR, so you'll find that at the bottom of the show notes for this episode. And of course you can go directly to AmericanFreedomRadio.com and become a subscriber or give a donation. We also have Patreon, of course. And if you want to support my work, you can also visit my Patreon page, which is just patreon.com/PierceRedmond. And of course if you sign up at the low price of $5 a month, you get access to the special subscriber-only bonus podcast. Most recently, I had Ed Opperman on talking all about what it takes to be a private investigator, the lifestyle of a private investigator. But we talk about a lot of stuff. We talk about Dog, the bounty hunter. We also talk about Bo Dietl's mayoral run here in New York, and I'll definitely anytime we get some good Bo Dietl news, I'll definitely talk about it on the show, because he's he almost makes Trump look like a class act, so that should give you an idea of who Bo Dietl is. Just a few other little things. I'm getting a lot of emails about Porkins' Great Game with Christoph Gehrman. We haven't forgotten about that show. I know it's been months and months since we put out an episode. Christoph and I are, we're going to try, I think for some time in June, to put out an episode. Lots of just stuff going on, with both of us. We just haven't been able to kind of sit down and actually record something. Both of us haven't even really been following the news in Central Asia and the Caucasus too closely, as of late. So we got to do a bunch of work. But if you're, fiending for some, news on that, I of course recommend, that people, check out, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, which is always a good go-to source. And they do, some really good podcasts as well. If I can plug a CIA, news outlet, the Majlis podcast, which is, put out every week, is a great podcast all about, Central Asia. And there's also, they do a brand new podcast, which I think comes out, every other or week after that, which is the Gundara podcast, which is all, focused on Afghanistan and Pakistan. So, if you need your Central Asia fix, I encourage people to go check out Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Maybe they'll give me a plug, after I've been plugging them. And a few other things. One, I know that, people have been getting, copies of the American Journal of Economics and Sociology that I've been sending out. I've got a few more to send out, and I will be doing that soon. So, you don't have to bug me with, where your copy is. It's on the way. But I know people have gotten it. And, if anyone out there, that's, comfortable with this, if you want to take a picture of, yourself with a journal, and send it to me, I might put together like a little video or something, just sort of talking about the journal. And I'd love to see, people with the journal. If you don't want to have your face in the picture, that's fine. If you want to just hold it up or something like that. But I've got a little project in mind for that. So if you feel comfortable and you want to, show your love and support of, me and everybody else that was involved in that, then, take a picture and, send it my way. You can just email it to me. But, more importantly, I have a huge announcement. A big, very big guest is lined up for next Tuesday. I'm going to have him, for both hours, and it is the one and only Pat McKenna. And for those who don't know, Pat McKenna is a world-famous private investigator, and his big, I guess, claim to fame was that he was the lead investigator for the defense for the O.J. Simpson criminal trial. So we're going to get Pat on. We're going to be talking all about O.J. Pat has been, very generous with his time, given us 2 hours. He's also sent me lots of his original notes from the case, so I have to go through all of those and start kind of outlining the episode. And people might also know Pat McKenna. He was the lead investigator for Casey Anthony's defense as well. So really fascinating guest. A big shout out to my good friend and friend of the show, Brian Heiss, who is he was the producer on this show. He put everything, in place and he got me and Pat in contact. So a big thank you to Brian Heiss for that. And definitely an episode to look forward to. Pat McKenna doesn't do, radio. He doesn't really do interviews. He does conferences and things like that, where he talks about the case, but he doesn't do interviews, let alone long form, 2 hour radio interviews. So this is a big coup for us here at Porkins Policy Radio. Very excited to have Pat McKenna on. So that'll be a really fun episode for next week. So definitely check that out if you can. If you can, listen to it live. Because I don't know exactly, and of course I'll this is the first time I'm telling Danny, but if we can, we might try and take some phone calls on the air. I think Pat is open to that, and he kind of suggested that to me. So if anybody wants to do that, I'll talk to Danny, of course, I'm sure, right after we're done recording and see the feasibility of all of that. But I do want to hello Jenny, I see that you've just joined us in the second hour. I do want to talk a bit about the recent developments in the Jeffrey Epstein case. I hope I'm not kicking a dead horse here. I think that by and large everybody is still fascinated by this. I know I am. And I wanted to talk about this last week, but I was able to coax Karim Kopp into staying for both hours, so I didn't get to this. But there has been actually quite a few really important developments going on, and I think it's worth continuing to follow this case for a variety of reasons. The first being that it obviously involves the God Emperor President Trump. Despite what his supporters will say, he is intimately involved in this, and I think there's reason to believe that I hopefully will lay out in a concise manner that it's getting closer to him too, that this is not going away, and that that it is beginning to sort of hit home for Trump. And I know that it's lately we've been stuck in a media cycle that's been obsessed with FBI Director Comey, with the Russians, with what Michael Flynn knew or didn't know. Now we've got the whole Seth Rich story, which is sort of just taken the alternative and the conspiracy media and the mainstream media by storm. Everybody is very fascinated on that. I don't know enough about Seth Rich to really talk about it. I do have some questions about what he may or may not have known or if he was involved. But I think it's also a really great distraction, and both sides are using that. You know, of course, the mainstream media will say, oh, well, Seth Rich is just a way, is just a distraction, for the alt media, because they don't want to talk about the fact that Donald Trump is a Putin agent. He's some sort of Russian Manchurian candidate. And on the opposite side, I think that the Seth Rich story is great to use to distract, for the conspiracy media, the alt media, like the dickheads like Mike Cernovich and others. He's a great distraction to distract from basically the everyday scandal that is Donald Trump's very existence. Whatever you want to believe with the Russia angle, there's something there, or else this would have gone away, and you wouldn't have people like Michael Flynn pleading the fifth. But more importantly, I think Seth Rich or stories of that nature are great to distract from stories like Jeffrey Epstein, like the Ghislaine Maxwell defamation suit that's going on right now, because those are stories that are on the periphery. Unless you're fairly plugged in, like I am, and like I think all of you are as well, it's very easy to miss those stories when you get, if you go on Twitter and all you're seeing is a bombardment of Seth Rich this, Seth Rich that, the Russians, Saudi Arabia, blah, blah, this, that, and the other thing. So I do want to talk about some of the stuff that's going on. So what is going on with Jeffrey Epstein? First and foremost, and this is really important, Richard Johnson, who is the Page Six gossip columnist for the New York Post, people might be familiar with him, he claimed in a recent article in the Post for Page Six that an insider, who knows who this insider is, but that an insider told him that Virginia Guaffieri's lawyer, David Boies, is actually asking her to settle the case. Now, this was previously touched on by Politico. There was a recent article, and I'll link up to all these. There'll be a lot of articles to go through in the show notes for this episode. But there was a Politico article talking about talking about the whole sort of Epstein saga and what's going on and how this might actually affect Trump. And they mentioned that there were rumors that a settlement was in the works. And then this was, further confirmed, in air quotes, by Richard Johnson. Now, we should take this with a grain of salt. This is the Page Six gossip columnist. He's not a reporter. He's saying that an insider told him this. He doesn't, of course, name who the insider is. He doesn't name really anything exactly to this. So we should take this with a grain of salt. But this is the second time that the trial has been postponed. I think originally it was due to like the 17th. Now it's been pushed to May 25th, which is just 2 days away. I have a feeling that it will probably be postponed yet again. So there is – the postponements are obviously signaling that there is something going on. Now let's break this down a little bit more because Wafiri wants Epstein to testify in regards to his role in introducing her to Prince Andrew. Now, this is a big development because previous, you know, Epstein has done his damnedest to not be involved whatsoever in the Guaffieri v. Maxwell defamation suit. And he's been relatively quiet when he does have his lawyers put forth a motion. That's sort of it. And there hasn't been much focus on Epstein when it comes to that case, in part because Guaffieri is really suing Maxwell. Epstein is just – I believe he's a respondent in this case. But Guaffieri actually wants him to testify that he helped introduce her to Prince Andrew, which is important to her case, of course, because not only is this one of the big allegations that Virginia Guaffieri has put forth, but of course, you know, Prince Andrew denied that he knew her. Maxwell said, no way, this isn't true. And then, of course, there's a picture of Prince Andrew and Virginia Guaffieri in Maxwell's London townhouse. So this is important. And Paul Casal, who is one of the other lawyers that's been with Guaffieri from the very, very beginning, he's spoken about this to the press, saying that it's very important for jurors to know how this happened. It's important for them to see what Epstein has to say on this. Again, because Epstein has never really spoken about anything specific to this case. He's always sort of avoided everything. And Casal wants to question Epstein about the 23 trips that Guaffieri took with him and Maxwell on his private plane while she was still a minor. So that's, you know, that's important to all of this. Now, Maxwell's lawyers, to play devil's advocate, Maxwell's lawyer, Jeff Paglucia, I believe is his name, says that this is really all about getting Epstein on the stand so that he'll invoke his Fifth Amendment privilege and that, that this is just showboating. Again, why is Epstein invoking his Fifth Amendment privilege? You know, Fifth Amendment privilege is also, it's sort of like a blanket statement. You know, when you invoke it, you may be invoking it not specifically because of the question that's being asked, but that if you answer the question, that's being asked, say, how did you get, can you explain 23 trips on your plane? If Epstein answers that, then he is open to further questions, you know, that could be totally unrelated to that. They could ask him a question about, you know, the allegations of money laundering and things like that. So a lot of people will invoke Fifth Amendment as a blanket sort of a tactic. They just sort of want to get, you know, everybody. They want to protect themselves on all levels. But again, you know, still, there's a reason, you know, there's a reason for all this. I mean, Epstein is deeply connected to all of this. Now, building up on that, there was a recent article in the Daily Caller by none other than Conchita Sarnoff, someone who I hope is familiar to everybody right now. She's the author of Trafficking and is, in my opinion, she is the conduit through which all important news about Epstein is filtered through. Sarnoff was the one that published the letter from U.S. Attorney Alex Acosta. She's the one that, you know, claims that she's the only one that's ever covered this case. And she is covered up for Donald Trump. Now, Conchita Sarnoff just, as I said, published a recent article in the Daily Caller alleging that Ghislaine Maxwell is missing or on the run. She says that she spoke to her lawyers and says that the lawyers don't know where she is at the moment. They can't seem to find her. They seemingly don't know where she, if she's in the country, if she's on, as I said, on the run, living underground. And this kind of caught me off guard. I thought this was, my God, you know, that's a huge allegation. Is it true, you know, or is Sarnoff running interference or something like that? Then I looked at the Jane Doe 43 case, which is directly going after Epstein, but Maxwell is involved in this as well. And in the Jane Doe 43 case, there was a recent motion for an extension of time to effectuate service on Ghislaine Maxwell. This was filed by Brad Edwards, who's also one of Gualtieri's lawyers and is also representing Jane Doe 43. So what does that mean, motion for extension of time to effectuate service on Ghislaine Maxwell? It means that they never served her with papers, that, you know, she never responded to subpoenas and summonses to appear in court. So this would lead someone to believe that this is true, that they don't know where Maxwell is. She hasn't responded to being served. So there might actually be real truth to this allegation that her lawyers don't know where she is. Now, again, just like with Richard Johnson and the New York Post, we should take everything that Sarnoff says with a grain of salt. Again, with a huge grain of salt, maybe, you know, a whole cup of salt, because Sarnoff is dirty as the day is long. She's been running interference. She's always the conduit through which all stories, important stories about Epstein and Maxwell and that whole saga, are always filtered through Conchita Sarnoff. So, and again, it should be important that who is the one reporter out there that's talking about Maxwell being missing? Conchita Sarnoff. And I don't even want to go through the whole Sarnoff thing. I've done lots and lots on her, so you can check out, previous episodes where I talk about Sarnoff. But this is pretty crazy. And I'll briefly say again, Sarnoff is she was the one that put out the story about Alex Acosta, who was a U.S. attorney who basically ensured that Epstein received this sweetheart deal. Now, on that note, just before Alex Acosta testified before Congress, because he is Trump's labor secretary, I believe, Sarnoff wrote another article in the Daily Caller, again, defending Acosta, okay? Even though he basically protected him and broke every sort of protocol by not notifying the victims before his sentencing. And Maxwell sort of goes through, Sarnoff in her article talks about how, well, yes, I mean, he wasn't perfect and he did some things that were a little bit questionable as a lawyer, but ultimately he's one of the good guys because he got Epstein in prison, even though it was a basically, nothing. You know, he only got a few months. He didn't even serve full time. He was on a work release program, so he could leave, Monday through Friday. He could just go about doing whatever the hell he wanted to. He only had to return at night. Allegations that he even left the country, that he flew down to the Caribbean, to his private island. He was meeting with all sorts of crazy, people while he was in prison. And then when he came out, he was given a hero's welcome by, Katie Couric and George Stephanopoulos and celebrities and all this sort of stuff. Even with all of that, even the fact that Acosta, was, clearly protecting Epstein, Conchita Sarnoff gives him a pass. He's a good guy. You know, even though he did the fucking bare minimum in terms of prosecuting this guy, that he didn't tell Epstein's numerous underage victims about the sentencing process, where they would have been entitled to have their say in all of this. Conchita Sarnoff is still saying, no, he's a good guy. And, of course, where does Acosta go to work? Well, he's going to work for Trump, who Sarnoff claims, had no connection to Epstein whatsoever. Trump is a good guy. Nothing to see here. And it's another thing that I had sort of forgotten about when I was going through all of this, that it only came up in this, I forget what the article was. But we should remember, too, that Acosta's mentor at Kirkland & Ellis, which is the law firm that Jeffrey Epstein used back in 2006, 2007, when he was being investigated. And that's Kirkland & Ellis, of course, is also the law firm that Conchita Sarnoff uses for what I believe is a bogus charity that she runs for sexually trafficked children. Same law firm as Epstein, you know, no conflict of interest there. But when Acosta's mentor, when he was at Kirkland & Ellis, was one of Epstein's main lawyers, Ken Starr. Okay? You know, that Ken Starr, of course, of Monica Lewinsky fame. And Monica Lewinsky was just in the news recently, talking about Fox News. So, you know, lots of great synchronicity here. So, again, keep all of this in mind, that we've got the same lawyers, working together. We've got the same law firms representing all these people. So a lot there. But taking a step back from all of this, this is fascinating. Where the hell is Maxwell? Does anybody know? How will this impact the case? Okay. Now, building on that, before we get there, one other quick thing on Sarnoff. In the Daily Caller article where Sarnoff alleges that Maxwell is missing, or that her lawyers aren't aware of where she is, she also brings up the Jane Doe 43 case, and she names Jane Doe 43. She gives the names. Oh, it's South African born. You know, I'm not gonna broadcast this woman's name. I mean, it's out there now, but I'm not going to do that. To my knowledge, this is the first time that her identity has been revealed. And I don't know if this is because it's such an obscure case that nobody is paying attention, this woman's name has been out there previously, so Sarnoff feels like it's fine to reveal this identity. But that's pretty crazy, and I would assume that's got to be illegal. especially when we're talking about sexual abuse victims, rape victims, things like that. The media is not supposed to broadcast who these people are. They're not supposed to publish the name of a person who is who has allegations against somebody that they were sexually abused or raped or things like that. Now, I did do a little bit of digging with the name, and I did see some stuff in some older court documents. I really kind of have to double check that, because it didn't look like the most reputable of websites, but it looked like they had a PDF from a previous court document involving Epstein, where there was a South African woman who I believe was a material witness against Epstein at one point, and she was named there. Now, it's possible that that these are two different people. It totally conceivable that there were multiple victims from South Africa that Epstein had become involved with. But again, this is, I think, sort of goes to the goes towards demonstrating the character of Conchita Sarnoff. This woman who claims to be the vanguard of sexually abused children, who is the crusader against Epstein, reveals the identity of a woman who is alleging some pretty horrific stuff against Jeffrey Epstein. And she's just naming who this person is. So now, of course, if you were paying attention to this, if you're following this, you know, I'm sure you can do a, you know, search on Facebook or Instagram, Twitter, and see who this person is. It's very easy in this day and age. And I was really shocked that this went completely unnoticed, that nobody seemed to bat an eye at this. Even though, for all intents and purposes, I believe in the article, I have to double check it again, that, you know, she's talking about, that this is a Jane Doe case, that we don't know the identity. I think she says, like, Jane Doe 43, aka so-and-so from South Africa. Why even do that? Again, if you're supposed to be the good guy in all of this, why are you revealing the identity of this person? And hold on, I just gotta take a sip of water here before we continue. I'm just seeing, quickly before we dive in, because there's a little bit more. I'm seeing a question in the chat room from a good friend of the show, Jenny. Is there anyone other than you and Ed, and maybe that guy from Palm Springs who you've had on, who's consistently following this? There isn't, is there? Not really. there are definitely other people that Robert Morrow, who's kind of an interesting character. He was on, he was following this from the very beginning, and he has followed this. He wrote that book, The Clinton's War on Women, with Roger Stone. That's a little questionable. I do know Robert Morrow has seemed to actually kind of distance himself from Roger Stone and has called out Roger Stone, as far as I know. And Morrow is sort of a bizarre character. I do kind of like him because he's so brash and kind of in your face, and he doesn't really care what other people think of him. He has followed this, and he does, I think he has some sources, or he definitely knows people who know people who have some knowledge of this case. And to Robert Morrow's credit, in between tweets of, anime girls with huge breasts, he was also, one of the few people that really brought notice of the rape allegations against Donald Trump and Jeffrey Epstein. This is involving this woman whose identity was also revealed, Katie Johnston. So Robert Morrow follows it as well, is a little bit cruder when it comes to it. But other than that, there really aren't anybody else that I can think of that follows it with any sort of degree of professionalism, maybe. You can look at, like, these idiots, I forget, the George Webb, who I've talked about on the show before, is a total – if he's not a shill, then he's a complete fucking idiot. He talks about Epstein, but always in this, that Epstein is part of some sort of organ trafficking scheme involving DynCorp and the State Department. And, there are people like that that talk about it. But people that are, like, following the case as it unfolds, no. That's the short answer there, Jenny. Back to the Jane Doe 43 for a minute, because there's also been some interesting developments with that, and I think that these also kind of tie into the Guaffieri case as well. So as I mentioned, there are these rumors that David Boies is pushing Guaffieri to settle, and as far as I know, no one on her legal team has publicly stated this. This is, again, an insider who told Richard Johnson at the New York Post gossip column that this is happening. And then we've got Jane Doe 43 filing a motion for the extension of time to effectuate service on Ghislaine Maxwell. So what's going on within the Jane Doe 43 case? Something I've talked about before. Couple things. So I went to Pacer and checked out the case. Interesting thing. Epstein and Leslie Groff, who is, again, one of the other defendants in that case, one of the other people who Jane Doe 43 is naming as being part of what she describes as a sophisticated sexual trafficking enterprise, Leslie Groff and Epstein have the same lawyers. So they're both being represented by Justin Y.K. Chu and Michael Champion Miller. And they're both from the law firm of Steptoe and Johnson. And And I'll get to why this is important and also a little bit about Steptoe and Johnson. But for people that don't remember, Leslie Groff was she was in charge of a lot of the schedules for the various victims of Epstein. She was also she seemed I think when I last spoke about this, I sort of characterized her as she sort of acted as the I think the girl's sort of first she was their initial contact once they were within this sexual trafficking enterprise. So Leslie Groff helped with like housing accommodations. She got them, you know, mostly apartments in Mark Epstein's building and other properties that he owned. Leslie Groff was the one that supposedly provided cell phones to the girls. I assume, I'm not, you know, dead certain on this, but probably whatever per diem or money that they were given for living expenses. And she was in charge of some of the sort of travel arrangements and things like that. I think from what I kind of gather and what I'm the way I interpreted what was laid out in Jane Doe 43's criminal complaint, Sarah Kellen, also known as Sarah Kensington, Sarah Kellen was, I believe, really in charge of travel arrangements when it involved flying on Epstein's plane. So Sarah Kellen is almost always on the plane when Epstein is on the plane. So if you go through a lot of the old flight records, that are, you know, they're all over the internet if people want to look for them. For the most part, when Epstein is on the plane with a victim, with Ghislaine Maxwell, with, you know, Bill Clinton and other foreign dignitaries, Sarah Kellen is almost always there. So Sarah Kellen was sort of fairly high up in the structure. And I believe Kellen answered directly to Maxwell. Now, Leslie Groff, I believe, is a little bit further down where she was arranging if the girls, you know, like, for instance, if they were traveling, like, on, you know, public transportation. So she would get them plane tickets if they were just flying, like, a regular commercial airline from New York to, Epstein's house in New Mexico, let's say. That seems to be what Leslie Groff was about. But also, you know, housing, cell phones, the sort of like day-to-day mundane things. Leslie Groff was in charge of that. Now, Leslie Groff and Epstein now have the same lawyers. Why is this important? Because previously, Epstein has distanced himself from people like Ghislaine Maxwell. If people remember, this is back many months ago now, Maxwell in the defamation suit was pleading that, you know, Epstein come to her rescue and save her. And that if Epstein, testified that basically this never happened, you know, she would get off the hook. And she even alluded it was either in like the Post or maybe it was in New York Magazine that reported on this, that, she basically hinted in it that you have immunity. You can say, you can lie on the stand because you have immunity from none other than Alex Acosta. But Epstein refused to come to Maxwell's aid. And thus far, he has done the same in the Guaffieri defamation suit. Now, Epstein, you know, most of the motions that he's filing basically are motions to, you know, preclude him from being involved in the case, not to save Maxwell's ass. Now, that's interesting because, again, Maxwell and Epstein were lovers for many, many years. They were close friends. You know, Maxwell, Epstein, and Trump, you know, all used to hang out together. There's a famous picture of Maxwell and Trump back in the 90s, I believe. And they were obviously intimately involved in whatever this much larger trafficking enterprise was. Yet Epstein has thrown her to the wolves. So it's interesting to see that he has aligned himself with Leslie Groff. you know, this is important because next to that, you know, Epstein kind of tries to maintain almost this like distance from Maxwell to the point where it's like they don't have anything to do with one another. That whatever Maxwell was doing with Guaffieri and others, Epstein wasn't aware of it. And Epstein, if you read through his own lawyer's accounts of all of this, you know, if you go back, I think this is like all the way back to, again, 2006, 2007, during the federal investigation into this, Epstein's lawyers claim that, well, yes, of course he was, you know, getting massages, but he never knew they were underage. You know, that this was really all Maxwell and others who were procuring these girls, and they knew they were underage, but Epstein never did. And Epstein himself never actually, contacted these girls. They came to him. So, you know, he's not really guilty of, whatever, soliciting underage prostitutes, whatever bullshit, legalese that they've been using to get out of this. It was really all the Maxwell and others. So the fact that he is, in cahoots with Leslie Groff is really important, because now we're seeing that, you know, Epstein is when pushed up, you know, into a corner, he's reaching for Leslie Groff. That's a big development, in that prior to this, Epstein has really wanted very little to do with any of the people that used to or probably still do work for him, like Ghislaine Maxwell. Who is Leslie Groff to Epstein? Obviously, I think what this also illustrates is that Epstein still has control over some of these people. I think with the case of Maxwell, she's too high profile, perhaps. And, you know, he can't be seen to be in any sort of collusion with her. But Leslie Groff is fine. And it's also important to note that there have been several motions put forth by Epstein, Groff, and Sarah Kellen in the Jane Doe 43 case, in which they say that really this girl's got no standing, that it should be thrown out. They're talking about, does the Southern District of New York even have jurisdiction? They're claiming that no crime was actually committed, that she hasn't laid out a crime or anything like that. So the three of them are obviously still talking to one another. That's important. Maxwell and Epstein, I really don't think they have any contact, or else Maxwell wouldn't be, speaking to him through a news article, like in the Post or in New York Magazine. So he's still in contact with these other people, which also leads me to believe that they're still operating, obviously, but I think this is more proof that they are still operating, that this is still ongoing, and that they are all now they're trying to protect their asses. Forget Maxwell. She's dead to us, you know? That's the mentality there. But we've got to protect ourselves, because this is, I think, again, the fact that Groff and Epstein have the same lawyers is also more proof that this is a lot more serious than they're letting on. Now, if you read through all the various motions that come forward on this, you know, it's not a big deal, there's no case, blah, blah, blah. Yet, they're obviously working together, which I to me signals that there's more to this, that they are afraid, and also that Epstein wants to be able to control these other women that were involved in these massive crimes that he was orchestrating. So, you know, same lawyers is even better, you know. I mean, I'm sure all the attorney client privilege is nothing when Epstein is footing the bill. So that's very important. Now, Steptoe and Johnson, this law firm, again, I think there was a lot of sort of, I saw various things sort of being put out there, and, you know, conspiracy media, alt media and things like that, you know, that Epstein was sort of, I don't know, maybe wasn't at, you know, the top of his game anymore or something like that. And I've even posited that before, that, you know, you might die a death of a thousand cuts. Steptoe and Johnson is, they almost make Kirkland and Ellis look like a rinky-dink law firm. So for people that don't, I mean, Steptoe and Johnson is massively wealthy, very powerful law firm. And just to name a few of the people that are that work for Steptoe and Johnson, and hold on while I take another sip of water. We've got John Rizzo, who was the general counsel to the CIA. Michael Vadis, who worked for the FBI. He was the associate deputy attorney general, the deputy director for the Executive Office of National Security. He was a Justice Department special counsel, and he also worked for the Defense Department. Just a guy by random that I found while looking at Steptoe and Johnson. And Steptoe and Johnson also employs Stuart Baker, who was the Assistant Secretary for Policy of the Department of Homeland Security and was also the General Counsel, counsel to the National Security Agency, excuse me. So he was the lawyer for the NSA. So this is a really serious law firm. This isn't, there are varying degrees of powerful law firms, in New York especially. But this is, this is not like a, the type of law firm that if you're like a big white collar crime, they do a lot of white collar crime, defending them. But this is not like a small, but influential private practice. This, we're talking about a massively powerful law firm that, employs just those three people alone have tremendous influence. I mean, we're talking about John Rizzo. I mean, he's a CIA agent. He still is, I mean, there's no way around that. You don't just work as the head lawyer for the CIA for years, famously under President Bush, and you just sort of, I'm done with the CIA. So he's got, this law firm has got access to CIA. It's got access to the FBI, Department of Homeland Security. As I just mentioned, Michael Vadis, the Attorney General's office. We're talking about the Justice Department, the Defense Department, the NSA. They're very powerful people at Steptoe and Johnson. So, I believe it's in the Gwafir Maxwell case, Epstein used different lawyers, a much smaller law firm, still very powerful, still very influential. I can't remember off the top of my head right now. I don't have the court documents pulled up. But the fact that with the Jane Doe 43 case, he's going for the big gun. I mean, he's going for, Kirkland Ellis on steroids. That should, I think, lead us to believe that this is a very serious case, that in spite of the pronouncements from people like Leslie Groff and Sarah Kellen and Jeffrey Epstein that Jane Doe 43 doesn't have any standing, that it should be thrown out. I mean, these are all – this is common. This is like textbook lawyer stuff. You always say, oh, it's got to be thrown out. There's no jurisdiction here. There's no standing. There's no crime is being alleged here. This is just, and it's very early on in the case. I mean, we're talking about, this is preliminary stuff. I mean, they haven't even been able to serve Maxwell yet. So the fact that he's bringing in this powerful law firm to defend him, the fact that he is obviously in contact with and coordinating with Leslie Groff is very important, because I think that means A, that Groff knows stuff that is, I mean, she knows where the bodies are buried for sure. And of course Maxwell knew that too, but I think Epstein saw Maxwell as just a liability and she was too high profile. Leslie Groff, I think he's still under his control. And ditto for Sarah Kellen, because, Sarah Kellen is also, has sort of, lent her name to several of these different motions. And interestingly, one of the other defendants in the Jane Doe 43 case, Natalia Malyashev, who was a victim of Epstein's and then later, moved up the ladder and became a procurer, she's nowhere to be found in all of this. You know, she's not in, seemingly not in contact with Epstein. They've left, you know, they've sort of put her out to pasture. You know, I'm just pulling up from the Southern District, the court filings. I don't even see lawyers listed for Malyushev. So she's obviously someone that they're going to throw to the wolves. She's not that important. But Groff, Kellen, these other people, you know, they're circling the wagons right now, and they've got to kind of close ranks, and they've got to make sure that everyone is on the same page, because a slip up right now could be very serious. So, to the naysayers who say that there's nothing to this case, you know, there's a lot of them out there. You know, and the most ridiculous of them are the people that, you know, defend Trump up and down, and think that this is just all kind of BS. And again, keep in mind too, all of the crimes, most of the crimes that Jane Doe 43 is alleging took place in New York. So was Donald Trump involved? I mean, I don't know, but, you know, it's more than likely that it was. So they are, I think they're running scared. I don't think it's the other way around. And furthermore, all of what we're seeing right now, the settlement rumors, the fact that no one knows where Maxwell is, that Epstein is coordinating with other defendants in this case. This left me wondering, is this all kind of like a smokescreen? Is this whole settlement thing BS? Is it a rumor? Is it media hype? Because again, all we're really getting is some insider who's saying this. Now, it very well might be true. Obviously, you know, a lot of the lawyers involved in both of these cases were also involved in suing Alan Dershowitz, and then they eventually dropped that. But even there, again, go check out Ed Opperman, did a show, talking about the Dershowitz settlement. And it's not like a settlement per se. You know, Brad Edwards and some of these other, Paul Casal, the lawyers, they basically said that they went about it the wrong way and they wasted too much time. But they could have, you know, but this, it was there. They could have done this. You know, and it wasn't really, like a win for Dershowitz. I mean, nothing is a win for Dershowitz right now, because his legacy will forever be, you know, intimately connected to this guy. And again, in the Guaffieri Maxwell defamation suit, you know, Dershowitz continually files these motions talking about how wonderful, Mike Cernovich is, and how Cernovich Media is, you know, we just want to applaud them and join their great fight to release the, you know, the statements, disproving everything that Virginia Guaffieri is stating. So, you know, again, keep that in mind. That's what Cernovich is about. He's not about getting documents proving that, Epstein was involved in this, or that Maxwell was involved in this. No, no, no. What he wants to do is he wants to release documents stating that she's a liar. So what if this is all kind of like a hype, a smokescreen? That's one possibility. And I think the fact that allegedly nobody knows where Ghislaine Maxwell is, she's obviously running scared. Okay. If she's not, responding to, you know, subpoenas and to summonses and things like that, obviously she's panicking. So and if she is, because okay, look, if Jane Doe 43 can't find her, then obviously the lawyers in the Guaffieri case involved in that defamation suit, then they probably can't find her. So if they can't find her, why the hell would Guaffieri settle? Okay? This is only making Maxwell look guiltier. So why even settle? You know, I mean, bring this up in court, that this woman that we're suing for, I mean, nobody knows where she is. So I think there's a lot more going on behind the scenes of all of this. There's a lot that's happening that, again, is obscured because of the sensational stories that are going on, in the media right now, like Seth Rich, Russia, Michael Flynn, You know, all these sorts of things. Now the other thing is, and I don't want to believe this, but it could be true, and I'll throw it out there, that Guafiri's lawyers really aren't looking out for her best interests. That this might be more about making a name for themselves, that they, you know, were sort of not stringing her along, but wanted to see where they could go. They're having second thoughts about this. They're having doubts that they can win the case. So they're telling her to settle. I don't know, I don't know that they really have all that much to gain from this because the case is so secretive. So it's not like, you know, this isn't Johnny Cochran and O.J. Simpson. Very few people know about this. So I don't know quite what they would have to gain from that. I mean, I guess some money, obviously, and some notoriety, but it's such obscure notoriety that I don't know quite if that's really what's going on. I don't want to believe that because, obviously I want this to come to light, and I don't want to think that Paul Casal and Brad Edwards and David Boies were, basically, you know, helping in the cover up. I mean, that's one of the assertions that we can get from this if they're asking her to settle. Keep in mind too, if they settle, there could very well be an admission of some sort of a guilt from Ghislaine Maxwell. Well, anyway, I am done talking about that for today. So please do stay tuned in next week with Pat McKenna. It's going to be a really fun interview. And until then, I'll be talking to you very soon.
News and information you can trust. This is American Freedom Radio. Freedom, freedom, American Freedom Radio. Radio. American Freedom Radio.
And I hope people support American Freedom Radio. And I hope people vote with their dollars and really understand the value of having American Freedom Radio. Because that's my family. If you love me at all, Jack Blood, support American Freedom Radio. Like, my family has literally disowned me in American Freedom Radio. Danny and Don and those guys, those are my actual family. So please, please support these guys because they have all the technology. They have all these great things that they're going to do, but obviously they can't do it all by themselves. So not only would I like to see you support them, I'd like to see you retweet them and repost them and really get involved and get on the bandwagon, so to speak, on doing that do-it-yourself promotion because they're a do-it-yourself radio network and we just need that so much.
Nutritious food is real body armor. It builds muscle, burns fat, improves digestion, and feeds the entire body the nutrients it needs. Did you know the U.S. government banned the hemp plant from growing in the United States and classified it as a Schedule I drug to hide it behind the marijuana plant? People have been confused about this plant for over 80 years, and many still don't know what hemp is. So now you know hemp is not marijuana, and marijuana is not hemp. They are different varieties of the same species. HempUSA.org wants the world to know these basic facts and to help people understand that hemp protein powder is the best kept health secret you need to know about. Remember, hemp protein powder contains 53% protein, is gluten-free, anti-inflammatory, non-GMO, and is loaded with nutrients. Call 888-910-4367, 888-910-4367, and see what our powder, seeds, and oil can do for you. Only at HempUSA.org.
We all know that they're not telling us the truth. So stand up for your rights, demand the real medicine, and your right to use it and grow it. This is Rick Sensen, and you're listening to American Freedom Radio.
The world is like a ride at an amusement park, and when you choose to go on it, you think it's real, because that's how powerful our minds are. And the ride goes up and down and round and round. It has thrills and chills, and it's very brightly colored, and it's very loud, and it's fun for a while. Some people have been on the ride for a long time, and they begin to question, is this real, or is this just a ride? And other people have remembered, and they come back to us, and they say, hey, don't worry, don't be afraid, ever, because this is just a ride, and we kill those people. The eyes of fear want you to put bigger locks on your door, buy guns, close yourself off. The eyes of love instead see all of us as one. Here's what we can do to change the world right now to a better ride. Take all that money we spend on weapons and defense each year and instead spend it feeding, clothing, and educating the poor of the world, which it would many times over, not one human being excluded, and we can explore space together, both inner and outer, forever in peace.
You're listening to AmericanFreedomRadio.com, the network who perseveres in delivering intelligent debate, constructive dialogue with true independence. The freedom to broadcast the truth is not free at all. So what is American Freedom Radio worth to you? The empowering information with fun, honest and pure integrity behind it provides an example to follow. Friendships to flourish with the moral altruism that pulls no punches. The hosts sacrifice and show remarkable discipline in their duty to deliver quality radio in service to the community with strength, wisdom and loyalty. The founders of AFR wish to thank you personally for sharing your views and insights to make the best radio and alternative media. Now it's time for you to give something back and play a vital role in the future of America. Be as generous with us as we've been with you. Click on the donate banner at AmericanFreedomRadio.com or volunteer by emailing AmericanFreedomRadio@ymail.com. Vaccines, psychotropic drugs, and artillery batteries not included.
No rules, no rules, no taboo topics, no taboo topics, no fear of doom, no fear of doom. We are American Freedom Radio, American Freedom Radio.